We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 139. The Yankees are kicking the Royals' ass right now as we record on Wednesday night. What's up, Scott?
What's up? This is a perfect time to do it. We got a 10-3 ball game. Michael Pineda is throwing a bunch of strikes and cruising through. So let's record a podcast. It's perfect timing. The Yankees are cooperating with us tonight.
Trying to erase those memories of that lost, ugly Houston series.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what we did is just ran into a super hot team, and luckily the Kansas City Royals were able to take care of the Orioles for us, which is very nice of them, and now they're laying down for us, which is even more, gracious. So these guys are just great hosts. I really do appreciate Kansas City right now.
Shout out to George Brett for that.
Shout out to George Brett.
Coming up later in the show, we talked to Brian Hoke of MLB.com. We talked to him on Tuesday night before Tuesday's game, but we discussed a lot of different things with him. Obviously the Jeter ceremonies, what the Yankees are going to do with Sabathia if he continues to struggle, even though he had a good start on Tuesday night, what the Yankees are going to do with Tanaka and maybe a mechanical flaw. So we had a lot of good stuff. We did about 25 to 28 minutes with Hoke. So stay tuned for that later in the show. And Scott, I saw you pumping some Instagram stories with some updates on the June 10th event. So why don't you say those now?
Yeah. So the email is going out tonight. I am wrapping it up right now so I can get it out to everybody, just about some more details of the event. So look for that. If you have purchased tickets, just make sure that the email is good. And I know everybody gives, I know what I do. I give out spam. I give out like my garbage email to people usually. And if I don't want to hear from them, or if it's something
your
I'm signing
email?
Up for, yeah, I have a burner email. So just make sure you're actually getting the emails and that they're not going to spam and that you do see it, because eventually, if you do sign up, your tickets will be sent through that email address. So it's a problem if you can't read it, the emails. But yeah, we're at 250. I think we've actually just passed 250 people. The last time we were recording, we were at around 200 plus. So we've had a nice influx of people come to sign up. And I expect, honestly, I expect another 50 to 60 more people showing up. I think once we start rallying everybody who's already signed up to get some more friends, and let's grow this group even more. Why not? I think we're going to get a nice influx. So sign up. We have a cutoff date for next Wednesday is the cutoff date if you want to get a t-shirt on the day of for the event, because if you do not, I have to get them to the print shop. I have to do all that jazz beforehand. So next Wednesday is that cutoff. If not, and you do order it, you're going to be paying a shipping cost for the t-shirt to be sent to you. So get it in by next Wednesday.
Wednesday the 24th.
The 24th. Thank you for looking at a calendar. Yeah, so
that's exactly what I just did. People are like, well, next Wednesday, I'm listening to this on a Tuesday. When does that mean? So,
but
yeah, Wednesday the 24th.
But yeah, we're progressing right along. It's the event is going well. We have to wait for the Yankees to send us the tickets. Obviously, we have them all lined up and ready to go, but the way that they release tickets is the same way if you were to buy it on like Ticketmaster or wherever. They release it at a certain point before the game. Sometimes it's 2 weeks before the game. So once we do all that, we get them, and we will be sending the tickets off to you guys who have purchased.
I'm excited. I cannot wait. Another thing that I can't wait for is the Jeter versus A-Rod podcast that we sort of teased last time. We're definitely going to do it. I've seen some tweets come through that people want to hear it. So send us your mailbag questions or thoughts and takes on the whole matter. We're going to go through it. We don't know exactly when we're going to record it, probably in the next week or two, but it's going to be basically the history, the saga that is Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez. So I'm really looking forward to that. Also, call the voicemail line for Monday's show to leave your voicemails, 646-480-0342. That's become one of my favorite parts of this podcast very quickly, is the last 5 minutes of those Monday shows, listening to people rant and rave.
Yeah, it's more fun not having us talk and everybody else go out and the show. It's actually awesome. I think when you and I first started the show, we had, you know, from the beginning, we wanted to include the entire fan base. We wanted to include everybody who listens to the show, whether it be mailbags or voicemails, as we're doing now. And it does. I think it's a lot of fun hearing you guys say what you want, say what you mean, and in your voice. I think it's expressed a lot better, obviously, through you saying it than us reading it, or at least trying to read it on the air.
Speaking of Alex Rodriguez, he is making his in-booth, in-game debut on Thursday night on Fox Sports 1, calling the Yankees and Royals game. I'm actually surprised that he's actually getting in the booth for an in-game call. I thought he would just be a studio guy.
Yeah, do we know who he's doing it with? Like, who's the...
Burkhart?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the guy used to do the Mets. He used to work with SNY, right? He's pretty good, actually. Kevin Burkhart's really good, I think. I think he's a guy who commands the game pretty well. I've heard him do a couple other things, and I think A-Rod will be fine. I think he'll be good. I'm not a big A-Rod guy in the first place. I do think that he's extremely knowledgeable of baseball, and the perfect scenario is rolling up here with the Yankees game. So, I mean, he knows this team inside and out. So, I mean, really, he's putting himself in a position to succeed.
How's this going to work? Because he's still on the Yankees payroll making like $25 million this year from the Steinbrenner. So how's it going to work? He can only be so critical.
Yeah, well, I mean, why? He's still getting the money, whether he's critical or not. I mean, he's still getting that money. That money is still coming in.
Did you see he did some Fox, some sort of speaking event? He posted on his Instagram. And he was speaking to a bunch of people. And he walks out and he says, "I am now full-time on Fox. Too bad they don't pay as well as the Yankees." And I sort of rolled my eyes because he's still cashing those $20 million checks from the Yankees.
Yeah. Unless Steinbrenner had the foresight of putting some kind of a clause in the contract where if we get rid of you and you go and join the booth somewhere, you can't talk badly about our team if that does happen. And that would be some ridiculous foresight if he actually had that. But yeah, dude, still cashing checks. I mean, that's a pretty good, nice little gig is cashing two different checks, especially when you're not working for one of them.
It's never fun to hear somebody who's made almost $500 million in their career complain about money.
He's speaking all over the place, too. I mean, you go on Instagram.
Oh, he's everywhere.
And, you know, whatever his little minion is running around next to him, taking pictures of his Starbucks and every speaking event he's in. I mean, he's going to colleges. He's going to, like, different businesses. I mean, the dude's all over the place.
He hosted Squawk on the Street or Squawk Box, CNBC morning show the other day, and he also announced that he's going to be a guest shark on Shark Tank coming up this summer. I am actually looking for. I like Shark Tank. I don't know if you're a fan of the show. I don't watch it all the time, but when I do watch it, I enjoy it. So I think watching him, Mr. Wonderful, and Cuban on a panel together are all bidding against one another. Because you know A-Rod's going to get competitive, and he'll buy something stupid. That'll be fun.
Yeah, I want to hear the banter with A-Rod. I could see Cuban throwing in a steroid joke under his breath somehow. I think it would be pretty funny if they did that.
So, as we said, the Yankees are dominating the Royals. They killed them in the first game 7-1. They're killing them in game 2. What's the score now? 10-3 as we're recording right now?
Yeah, 10-3, runners on first and second. Judge has got a base hit.
The Royals, like you said, did the Yankees a favor by sweeping Baltimore. And they're last place in the AL Central. And it's easy to see why. Their pitching staff stinks. Somehow, Jason Vargas was leading the league in ERA. He put up a stinker tonight. And thank God, because he's one of these junk ballers that I was just going to be pissed off and annoyed by if the Yankees couldn't hit him. He reminded me of, like, Chris Capuano, just slightly more talent. But, I mean, it's easy to see why this Kansas City Royals team is struggling. This is not that same World Series back-to-back appearances team.
No, I mean, their pitching staff isn't even remotely close to where it was, and their offense just doesn't have the same feel. Alex Gordon's having a terrible year. He was batting like 150, I think, coming into the year. And then you're looking at Vargas. Like, Vargas is the ERA leader, really? How is this even possible? The guy, I mean, yeah, Singleton was talking about him being a finesse pitcher before the game, right? I mean, that's a very nice way of saying your fastball is unimpressive. I think it's like 84 to 86. His changeup is like 80. So, I mean, I'm almost looking for the changeup because it's really not that much different than the fastball. You can almost foul off the fastball if you want to. Dude's throwing changeup after changeup after changeup. It's crazy.
That's a very, very delicate way of putting it, that he's a finesse pitcher. He's a junk baller.
Yeah, he's bad. He's a lefty who has a job because he's a lefty.
That's true. And the Yankees are going to be facing another lefty in Danny Duffy on Thursday night. The Yankees have struggled with lefties the last couple years, but this year they seem to be handling them a little bit better. not including Dallas Keuchel.
Well, right. That's what happens when you have a lineup that's, you know, flexible and has actual right-handed bats that can do damage against left-handed pitching. I mean, it becomes a problem when you can only stack lefties against your the tough left-handers that come in. So Girardi's loving it. He's able to do what he wants with this lineup, and, you know, up and down, really, there's no bad move because everybody's doing pretty well. I mean, honestly, the up and down the lineup, everybody's hitting. It's pretty amazing.
Think about the Yankees are stacked with right-handed hitters between Judge and Sanchez and Castro and all the switch hitters with Headley and Hicks, Carter, and then Didi, one of the lefties, dominates lefties.
Yeah, he's slaying left-handed pitching. So Girardi can do no wrong at this point. I mean, he's looking terrific.
And he sits. He's going with, I've noticed that anytime there's a lefty on the mound, either Gardner or Ellsbury sits every single time, which right. I'm fine with.
Yeah. I mean, we've been calling for that for a while, so there's no issue with that. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, especially when Hicks is playing. I mean, Hicks is playing his way into the lineup every single time.
Seven home runs.
Yeah. I mean,
he's
got
seven home runs.
He's having a phenomenal year. I don't know how much more praise we could give this entire team. And there's no limit to the praise because all of these guys, even Headley's hitting again. I mean, not to what he was early in the season, but he's hitting again. You wanted some consistency, some more leveling off. And I think that's kind of what you're getting right now. He's definitely doing a lot more leveling off. It's not as drastic as it has been. So look, I mean, there's just so many flexible moves that Girardi has and it's paying off. I mean, this team is rolling right now.
The only consistent thing I see out of Headley is that he's 5 for 5 on stolen bases.
Yeah, and he made a phenomenal defensive play last night.
He made a couple good plays on Tuesday night. He actually saved CeCe.
I'm telling you.
CeCe pitched well, but he was giving up some missiles down at
third base. Dude, I'm telling you, Chase Headley is one of the best in the major leagues at going towards the bag. I'm serious. That guy, he is phenomenal at fielding the position.
Can we get stat
towards
cast
the
on
bag?
That?
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of a stat on, you know, which way they go, left or right, and the metrics on that. So somebody who's listening to this, give me some advanced metric of Chase Headley to his right because he's phenomenal. Now I don't know if he's making the throw, but he's gloving it.
Headley can't go both ways?
No, he only goes one way. One-way guy.
The Yankees also coming up. They go to Tampa Bay for 3 games, and they're in second to last place, below 500. And then they come home, and they play 7 games against Kansas City and Oakland, 2 last-place teams. Obviously, they're playing Kansas City right now. So this is a stretch in the schedule before it starts to get tough again where they could really have a hot streak and really go a long way into setting themselves up for an even better summer than they've already done.
So we're expecting that not to happen then, right? Because I feel like in the past couple of years, this is like the opportunity for us to go, you know, in the past couple of years, it was, we can go above 500. We can finally do it. And then no, but this is actually a different team. The only thing that concerns me in here, I mean, Kansas City and Oakland look like 2 very winnable series. Tampa Bay, I mean, yes, but they have struggled, but at the same time, they always give us a fit. Especially at the Trop, like, weird things happen at that place. So I got nothing with that one. I don't know what will happen. Hopefully they'll take advantage of it. But weird things happen at the Trop.
We've got to throw out all the playbook on this team. We don't know. We're in uncharted waters with this team. It's a totally different team than recent.
No doubt.
Years.
There's no doubt. And thank God, because I don't know if we could do a third year in a row of what we did for the last 2 years. The last 2 years were pretty painstaking as far as the amount of talent that was on a team that underperformed.
Yeah, you want to listen to 2 people losing their mind, go listen to a podcast from last May.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
I heard Susan on the pregame today say that the Yankees are already 10 games over 500. They didn't reach that until late September of last year. And that was they only reached it last year because Gary Sanchez single-handedly carried them 10 games over 500.
Man, we should be rebuilding every year. This is such a great process. It's so much fun. It's easy.
Sanchez was the face of the Yankees after 2016, and then a month into 2017, Aaron Judge is the face of the Yankees, and he's on Jimmy Fallon's show and doing all that stuff. What'd you think of that video?
So people were comparing it to, you know, not comparing directly on the performance, but the fact that he was on the Late Show to the Cano Late Show. I thought the Cano one was a bomb. I thought it was terrible. I thought Cano wasn't very good. I thought the complete opposite on this one. I thought Aaron Judge was very good, looked very natural, was personable, and this dude is going to be, no pun intended, a giant superstar. He has it. He's got everything you need. And the best quote of the day, whether it was professionally written or not and delivered by an actor or an actual Yankee fan, still up for debate in my opinion, was that there's only two gaps in New York, and it was Strahan and Judge the other one. That was a good line. It was.
Do you know how I know that guy wasn't a Yankees fan? Is because at the beginning of the video, he said his favorite player was Ellsbury.
Yeah. Does that ever? I've never met a Yankees fan whose favorite player is Ellsbury.
And I'm sorry, if you've watched three Yankee games this year, you could identify Aaron Judge if he was standing right in front
of you. I don't get it. Like, I know they lowered his seat, but he's still a massive human being. He's a giant.
Even if the size of him physically doesn't give it away, the gap tooth gives it away.
Why? I never understood, like, why when someone puts glasses on, do they become
it's
a
like
different
Clark
person?
Kent.
I know. I never really understood that about Superman either. I'm like, it's Superman, obviously, with glasses. I never really got that, how that's a disguise. They don't even have a fake nose. It's just the glasses.
I wrote, when I did a little blog about that video, I wrote that, I mean, baseball, MLB has basically struck a gold mine with Aaron Judge. He's the perfect recipe for marketing. He's huge. He hits bombs. He's really mild-mannered on the field, really nice off the field, says all the right things, is always interacting with fans. Like, they struck a gold mine with him.
Yeah, there's everything you want about this guy. Like, he hits every demographic. He goes everywhere. He's perfect. He literally is perfect. They are begging and praying that he continues to hit and hit and hit, because like you said, he's a gold mine for them. And the New York Yankees are so happy about this. And I guarantee they didn't really see this big of a thing come. I mean, obviously nobody saw it, but I mean, do you think that even, you know, the 2-3 year projections were anything remotely close to what's happening?
No, I don't. We talked in the offseason that I kind of got the sense that Cashman didn't have much faith in Aaron Judge.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the overwhelming, you know, majority of people's opinions, is that, I mean, there was a competition, quote unquote competition, for right field in spring training. I mean, it wasn't given.
It was down to the last day.
Yeah. So there, the fact that he's just lit it up, you know, has to be a big surprise, you know, to the organization as well. I mean, usually I'm sure they have longer projections. There's no way he's even close to what their projections were, you know, even 3-4 years down the line.
Well, you got projections. I mean, I don't think anyone ever would have projected this. He's on pace for still, even though he slowed down in home runs, he's still on pace for over 50 home runs.
Right, but I'm not even talking about the pace I think the batting average and just his approach at the plate is the most impressive thing for me.
His approach.
The approach at the plate, the way he's done it, the way he's taking walks, the way he is, you know, grinding out at-bats and then getting a base hit. Like, those are the telltale signs for me that this is a real thing and that he's getting it and that he's more comfortable. And it's going to be very difficult to pitch around him because, you know, everybody always saying wait till the league catches up. Well, the league's going to catch up by throwing things out of the zone, not hitting the places where he has been, you know, extremely hot in the strike zone. And he's just not swinging at those pitches. He's being so disciplined that you have to come at him or he's going to take his walk. And that's what's going to happen right now. And it's just going to get better as he gets older and more comfortable and sees more of these pitchers. It's really like the speed in which this happened is unbelievable.
It's as if he was brainwashed in the offseason to be able to have this sort of approach at the plate, because I didn't think it was possible after watching him last year. I thought he's going to run into 30 home runs if he gets full playing time just because he's that strong. But no one saw this kind of plate discipline. He had two walks on Wednesday night plus a base hit, you said, right? Right when we got on, he had a base hit. So he's on base three times. The length of the Yankees lineup is the biggest difference for me. Throw out Carter because I know he had three hits on Tuesday night, but that's going to be few and far between. Every squirrel finds a nut every now and again. And
he got another hit and scored from first tonight too. I mean, the guy's on a roll. Two games.
Whatever. But 1 through 8, this Yankee lineup is pretty damn solid.
Yeah, I mean, and you're saying 1 through 8, and knowing that Chris Carter is our backup first baseman. So, you know, in theory, we're waiting for our starting first baseman, your MVP candidate, yeah. no doubt.
Got him rolling his eyes at Derek Jeter. And like,
I didn't make him roll his eyes. I didn't make him roll his eyes.
Conspiracy videos going on, so yeah. Who knows when he's coming back.
I didn't make him walk all unathletically next by Derek Jeter while Jeter's like the man of the hour and rolling his eyes, looking very just completely down and out like a nerd. It was weird. Weird video. Weird video going on there.
Now he's a nerd.
He was like I tweeted whoever there was a girl I was going back and forth on Twitter who saw the video as well, and I made the comment saying that he looked like the nerd in high school, like walking by the starting varsity quarterback, like just angry and just like frustrated and, you know, looking unathletic. It was just a weird look in that video. I'm telling you, go back and look at that video if you haven't looked at it.
I'm talking
to people listening to this. It's weird. It's a strange video.
We don't know who he was talking to from behind the cage, what was said. Jeter could have said something sort of funny or something, whatever, that just annoyed or made Bird sort of roll his eyes. You don't know. You saw a half a second of Greg Bird on that video.
I am very perceptive when it comes to reading body language. I'll tell you, that is one of my strong suits as a person. And I'm telling you that Greg Bird at that particular moment was pissed off and annoyed and aggravated and somehow felt belittled as a man when he was walking by Derek Jeter.
Oh, I love it. I love the conspiracies here. We talked to Brian Hoke coming up. Like I said, it was before CeCe's start on Tuesday. And we asked him, what do you think the Yankees are going to do with CeCe? He didn't think the Yankees are going to really make a move on him anytime soon. You'll hear why coming up. But CeCe went out there and sort of put his money where his mouth is. 6 2/3 innings pitch, no earned runs, 5 hits against the Royals, took advantage of the big ballpark. Yeah, he gave up some hard hit balls, but that's going to happen when CeCe's throwing 90 miles an hour, topping out at 90 miles an hour or whatever. Looked good. Looked like he did in his first 3 starts of the season, not the 10 ERA guy we saw in the 4 starts after that.
And this is promising because when you break down the bad starts that he had, they were isolated to the first couple innings, which is just so strange to me for a pitcher like him and the way that he's developed into this new, quote, finesse guy and able to, you know, hit those corners and just really work with what his new repertoire is. So, you know, maybe there was some kind of a mechanical thing. Maybe there was some kind of a slight adjustment that he was able to make to get through that first part of the lineup and then, you know, get into the game where even in the bad starts, he was looking good. I mean, he got into the 5th or 6th inning in some of those bad starts, and because he settled down and actually got into the game, I mean, granted, he had given up, you know, what was it, 5-6 runs in each of those, but he did slow down and get into the game and ended up pitching well. So, you know, maybe there is something there, and hopefully he found it. I know they were talking tonight about angry CeCe, and he was just kind of pissed off that, you know, he was taking it out on the Royals and on the game. And, well, if that's the case, then bring out angry CeCe every single time. Somebody's got to poke the bear.
Seriously.
You know, and let's get this guy pissed off before every start, if that's what works.
I did appreciate Girardi's analysis of why Sabathia was struggling in his last few starts. He was just missing his location.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, right? It's so simple.
Thanks, Girardi. We couldn't tell that he was setting up low and away, and he hung a 87-mile-an-hour slot ball in the middle of the plate that went for 500 feet. Sometimes I know Girardi has to comment, but is some of the cliches that are said from managers or GMs or analysts or whatever it may be, just kind of
pisses me off. Dude, think about how many times they have to answer these questions. How many times in a summer?
Of course, I know.
If you don't have a number of cliche, I mean, he's got an entire chapter of cliche answers in that binder. If you don't have that and you don't have like a baseline of cliche, then you're just going to be one, either silent or just talking gibberish. You got to have those go-to answers. It's not what you want. You don't want to go through those long interviews.
It's not what you want. It's not what you want. Castro on Wednesday had 3 hits as of the time we started recording. RBI double in the first inning. He's now leading the league in hits. He was sort of going back and forth with hits on that, but I think after 3 hits, he's now definitely leading the league in hits. He's on pace for a career high in homers at 30 RBI, slugging percentage, OPS. He's on pace for not only his best season, but MVP-type yeah. season from Castro. At what point are we going to actually buy in that he might be one of the best infielders in the league offensively? I know defensively he has some struggles. He made an ugly error over the weekend. But as far as offensively goes, I mean, the dude's been a force. He's batting cleanup.
Yeah, he does make some boneheaded errors, but he also makes some nice plays. I mean, he made a nice play in the hole going towards first base tonight. I've always thought that he's a guy who has the ability to hit for average, and that's just because of his hand eye. I think he's got some of the best hand eye and able, you know, the ability to get the bat to the ball wherever the ball is. Better than as good as anybody in the league. I think he's one of those guys. Like, you know, we've always talked about he's a good bad ball hitter, similar to like a Vlad Guerrero in the sense of they can hit anything. And that's why he does swing at those big sweeping breaking balls out of the zone, because he does think he can hit them. And sometimes he does. But, you know, I think he's always had that ability. And I think the biggest hurdle for him to, you know, to take the leap of where he was, you know, at the end of his Cubs career, where he was towards the middle parts of the end of the season last year, was to get that discipline and stop swinging at those terribly bad pitches and to focus on certain zones. And that's what's happening right now. I mean, he's hitting, it looks like he's swinging at better pitches, and when he does, he's mashing the ball. I thought he was going to kill Jason Vargas today. It looked like Vargas had zero chance. I mean, Castro was like smirking, waiting for the ball to come in. He's like, I'm going to crush this wiffle ball coming at me right now.
I know he's got a higher walk rate this season, and it just seems to me, I'm going eye test here, that he's swinging at fewer bad pitches. He still chases a little bit, but right. I see it less and less.
Yeah, and that's key. That's huge for him. I mean, when he stops doing that and he's really narrowing down his zone with that kind of hand eye and the ability that he has, because I think he does have, you know, some of the best ability in the majors. You know, I think the sky's the limit, and he's out there having a blast too. Dude's always got a smile on his face. I mean, does anybody miss Robinson Cano at this point? Anybody even talking about that ever again? Because this guy looks like he's having just as much fun with that big smile that Cano used to have, and is putting up very similar numbers right now.
So you didn't answer my question. At what point are we ready to call him one of the best offensive infielders?
You're buying
the Castro stock.
Yes, I bought early on Castro. I had a premonition. I didn't think that he was going to hit 350 or 345 or whatever the hell he's doing, but I did think he could hit I did think he could be a 300 hitter. So I'm happy that he's doing it, and yeah, I'm all in. I think especially with the people around him. I mean, look at that lineup. He's got backup everywhere he's go. Anywhere in the lineup he's got support, whether it's before or after him. So he's going to get good pitches.
He had no support last year.
Zero.
Especially the first three quarters of the season. So absolutely, that's a huge factor in it. I don't know if I'm ready to say that he's one of the best offensive infielders in the league. But I mean, we have to think about that he's 27 going on 28 years old. He's been in the league since he's 20. But historically, this is when players enter their prime. Right. So him and Didi are entering their primes, and it annoyed us to no end this offseason. What people were already set to move on from Starlin Castro because we had Gleyber Torres and all Tyler Wade and all the number of great prospects. Well, look what Castro's doing right now through almost 2 months of the season.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those cases where fans need to check themselves when they start looking at the minor leaguers and getting overly excited, because it happens. I mean, granted, this was such an influx of minor league talent that we hadn't seen in a long time that people got overly excited. And I understand it. I mean, why wouldn't you? Of course you are. You see all these guys putting up, you know, video game numbers in spring training. You automatically think that they could do it in the major leagues, and they can't. It's not the same. It's different. I mean, Gleyber Torres was struggling in AA before he got injured. So there's a number of things and a number of factors. Castro is a real deal major leaguer. Didi is a real deal major leaguer. These guys are doing it with consistency now, and they're getting better. So they're not going anywhere.
There was almost too many prospects all at once that came into the Yankee system. People started freaking. They lost their shit. We all lost our shit.
Yeah, we geeked out. Everybody geeked out about the prospects.
Which is fine, but... Yeah.
And they're still there. That's the beauty.
Still there.
They're still there. And the guys in the major league level...
We still have our number one and number two prospects still in the minor leagues. Like you said, Gleyber's in AA. Clint Frazier's snapping bats over his knee in AAA.
Exactly. Just getting ready. Getting primed. getting ready for when we need them, because these guys up here are handling business. It's perfect. It's really the perfect scenario, to tell you the truth.
The first time that Clint Frazier strikes out in the major leagues and snaps his bat over his knee, the New York media is going to go ape.
Oh, yeah. There's no, I don't think you can control that, though. It's very instinctual at that point.
Oh, sure, fine, show emotion. I love it. I don't think every player needs to be cut from the same cloth, but this guy is going to throw the New York media, the Yankees, specifically the Yankees media, into a frenzy because he's different, and it's fine. Whatever. All right, before we get into the Brian Hoke interview, take a minute to rate and review the podcast in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, wherever it is you listen. It really helps us out. Give us that 5-star review. Give us a rating and review. We appreciate it. All right, let's get into this interview with Brian Hoke. Now joining us on the podcast is Brian Hoke. He covers the Yankees for MLB.com. You can find him on Twitter at Brian Hoke. I'm sure everybody listening already follows him, but if not, definitely go follow him. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be on with you.
So the weekend was, I think, overshadowed by Derek Jeter, even though the Yankees lost 3 out of 4 to Houston. But how were the ceremonies up close in person?
I think it was cool. I think that Derek Jeter Day is one of those generational days that people are going to look back on, the way that you see the video footage of Mickey Mantle Day and how cool that was. And to be able to say you were there, whether you were in the stands or in the press box, or, I mean, I guess some of the guys on the field thought it was awesome to be there and up close. And I think it's hard to say anything bad about Derek Jeter. I think even if you're not a Yankee fan, you have to have an appreciation for the career he put together, for playing 20 years in New York City, for never really putting his foot in his mouth, and obviously for winning. You know, obviously a cornerstone of some of the best Yankee teams of all time. So it was cool to be there. I think that Jeter obviously nailed the speech. He did it in his own style. I think that the ceremonies hit all the right notes. And, like Tino Martinez was saying, it's no surprise. We all expected Derek Jeter was going to be out there someday. It's just a matter of time. But it was cool to finally see it happen, and now all the single digits are gone.
So talking about Derek Jeter and, you know, the ceremony, everybody's been looking forward to this, obviously. I'm very curious as to, you know, what your thoughts are on how you covered him, how it was like to cover him, you know, from the beginning Jeter years when he was a younger guy coming into this, you know, renowned organization, to the later years where he seemed to maybe a little bit more guarded as he got older, or started saying less in interviews and things like that. But I'd love to hear your take on what it was like in person to cover him.
I wish I could tell you, because in 96, I was a freshman in high school, so I wasn't around when Derek was breaking into the league, but obviously I saw him from afar and got to meet him a couple times. But the first time I saw him on an everyday basis was 2007. That was my first year on the Yankee beat. So Derek was already the captain by then. He was already the man and had the 4 of the 5 World Series rings he would have. So he was already a presence. But as from a coverage standpoint, I do remember vividly my first day of spring training, walking up to him and introducing myself and saying, "Hey, I'm the new kid here. I'm for MLB.com." And he shook my hand, looked me in the eye, said, "Hey, good to meet you." Asked me a little bit about myself, and then he was on his way. But that was pretty much Derek. He was always available, always professional, courteous, never really gave you all that much, as you know. I mean, his quotes, I think there's a reason that they play him in media training when the Yankees go to spring training every year. I mean, he nailed it. He mastered the art of make himself available, and always he's in the paper every day. I think that during his playing career, if you picked up a newspaper, you probably saw a quote that said Jeter said. But go back and think about the most outlandish thing that you ever heard Derek Jeter say. Remember the one that created back page headlines, and I have trouble coming up with one. So I think that he did it right. He obviously was very aware of his image and what he meant to represent the Yankees in a professional way. And I think it was also an offshoot of the team he was playing for, because remember, he came up with those George Steinbrenner Yankees, which also had all those veterans, the Tim Raineses and the David Cones and those guys, to show them the way and kind of learn, hey, this is how you be a big leaguer and this is how you conduct yourself. And you know, I wonder if it would have been different if Derek had been drafted by one of those other teams, if he had come up with a Houston Astros or the Cincinnati Reds. But I suspect that no matter where he played, Derek Jeter was going to be Derek Jeter.
You mentioned the Derek Jeter style of talking to the media, and Scott and I always joke that like Greg Bird and Aaron Judge seem to have gone to the Derek Jeter school of interviewing. That certainly seems to be the case. And then you see on the other side, Clint Frazier coming up, and he was not drafted by the organization, and he's making a little bit more of headlines. Do you foresee that being an issue at all in New York?
I don't. I think there's room for different personalities in New York. I mean, Nick Swisher had a good run in New York, and he clearly wasn't out of the Yankee school. And I know, obviously, it didn't end on a great note for Nick with the playoff game, but most of his career there was pretty good. And you've had guys who have personalities. David Wells was very successful in New York, and I don't think anybody would look at him as the button-down, suit-and-tie Yankee type. So I think that there's room for all of it. But you're right in that when you're drafted by the Yankees and you come up through the Yankee organization, I think from day one, they drill it into you. And part of that is looking at the guys who came before you. I'm sure that Jeter did that a fair amount when he was coming up through the farm system. And they probably threw the examples at him of the guys from years past. So I think that, look, the model is there. Whether players want to take it or not, I guess they have that option. Clint Frazier seems to have toned it down a little bit. At least he did in spring training when I was around him. I can't speak to it now because I'm obviously not around him every day, but I think that it is a learning process. And Reggie Jackson was talking about that a little bit in spring training too. And he had a personality where he made some waves, but even he was talking about how when you come to the Yankees, it's just different. The expectations are different. The spotlight is different. And so you have to conduct yourself a little differently.
Well, and yeah, today, I mean, you mentioned Boomer Wells and even Reggie Jackson, some of those early guys and on those teams where they did have bigger personalities and they were out and, you know, they're out in New York and doing all sorts of different things. But I think with today's age and social media, you know, there's obviously a different type of scrutiny. There's media all over the place. I mean, everybody is a photographer. Everybody's a journalist because they have a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do the Yankees, you talked about how they have Jeter as, you know, one of the examples on how to conduct interviews and such. I mean, are they really, you know, driving home to either lay off social media as much as you can during the season or just be smart about it? Or what's their stance on that?
I think they've kind of adapted to it. I think that the way that Twitter exploded and obviously Instagram and all these other things, you kind of kept your distance in the first few years and just said, whoa, what is this? Like, wait, how do we use this?
Right.
And I think you've seen more of the Yankees embrace it. Didi Gregorius is great on social media. That's one example I can think of off the top of my head. Gary Sanchez is very active on it. Aaron Judge is on it as well. I think that it's part of the landscape now, guys. I saw baseball cards the other day, and they have Instagram handles and Twitter handles on the back, and I couldn't believe it. So I think it's here to stay. It's going to be part of the landscape. I think that players are going to have to understand and appreciate that this is their way to speak to the fan base. I think that part of what Jeter has done in his post-retirement with starting the Players Tribune is a realization that there are other ways to get your message out there than to just talk to the five or six reporters who are out at your locker every day. And hopefully they never forget about that and they still talk to us, because otherwise we'd be in some trouble. But I think that it's great for the fans, I think, to be able to reach out to certain players. I know that some of the guys, it can be positive and negative what comes back at them. So some of the guys have kind of backed away from it a little bit. But I think for the most part, on the whole, the Yankees understand that their guys are going to be active on it, so be smart about it. Realize that what you're saying or tweeting is the same as what you're saying to a reporter, because it is. You've got a microphone there. It just happens to be a cell phone in your pocket, and what you say carries weight. So be careful what you say is what you actually want to be quoted as saying.
You mentioned all of the single-digit numbers with Jeter are now retired. Andy Pettit's numbers retired, Posada's numbers retired, Bernie Williams, obviously Mariano. Do you think they went a little overboard in honoring the 90s teams? I mean, O'Neill also has a plaque. Tino has a plaque. I don't know if I'm forgetting anybody. I love those teams. I grew up with those teams. But do you think that they went overboard at all?
Maybe a little bit. I think that they got swept up in, obviously, it was the 20th anniversary of the 96 team, not too far back. But I think that you're looking at people who watch those teams and grew up watching those teams, the 98, 90, 99, 2000, these are the guys who are now buying tickets, who are now bringing their children to Yankee Stadium and starting that next generation of fans. So I think that, look, I don't think it's a bad thing for a father to bring his kids into Monument Park and say, hey, this is who Paul O'Neill was. He was the warrior. He always got angry. He did this. He did that. Tino Martinez was the first baseman, and here's some of my favorite Tino memories. I think that's cool that it will connect the generations. So if you're asking me, do Tino Martinez and Luke Gehrig belong in the same sentence, I'm going to say no. But I think that Monument Park is a place where you recognize the great Yankees, and who's to say where the line is drawn, really? I think that if you want to have guys, you know, like we said, Tino or Paul O'Neill or Mel Stottlemyre or whoever you want to throw out there. I mean, Willie Randolph belongs out there, I think. Look, I think that it's a place where you recognize the great Yankees, and not everybody's going to be Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, and Mickey Mantle. So I think you understand that going in, and it's just part of it. You take a look around and take it for what it is.
Well, hopefully they can expand Monument Park if that's the case, because it's getting a little crowded.
Absolutely. It is a little tight in there, and I think that's the last ceremony we're going to see for a while. I think that Jeter is the last big one. I can't think of anyone else. I mean, who knows? Maybe Bryce Harper has one in a few years, and
Shane
we'll talk
Spencer.
About that. But, yeah, well, I don't know if they're going to have Shane Spencer today anytime soon. We'll see.
It was a nice bow on an era, I think.
I think so. I think that you're not going to see anything for a while, but hey, maybe Gary Sanchez Day or Aaron Judge Day is in the future. We'll find out.
Where did the Carlos Beltran coming up with the Monument Park Blazers come from? And how did we not all hear about this beforehand? It was odd when they mentioned that it was Beltran's idea for these, you know, for these Friars Club like Blazers for the Monument Park guys. Where did this come from?
Isn't that crazy? Apparently it happened at some point last year, and they didn't really publicize it too much. I had heard that they were working up a Monument Park logo. I had heard something about that, but I didn't realize that was what was going to be put on the Blazers. So a cool idea. I think he was inspired by what the Cardinals do with their Hall of Famers. Obviously, to me, they look kind of like the Masters jackets. I don't know how much guys like Andy Pettitte or Jorge Posada are actually going to wear them around town and you know, go out and maybe get dinner in one, but it's something that they can kind of say that they got from the Yankees. And I think, hey, if you have that, it's pretty cool.
All right, let's talk about the team that's playing right now. Tanaka looked terrible on Sunday night after the Jeter ceremonies. He's kind of looked shaky all season, in my opinion. What do you think's going on with him?
I'm not sure. They say it's a mechanical issue, and he hasn't really felt completely mechanically right. Even in spring training when we were talking to him and he was lights out and basically no hitting the world every time out in spring training, he would say something's not completely right. It could have been better. I'm getting good results, but I'm not completely satisfied. And you look at the way that Tanaka is, he's obviously a perfectionist. I honestly think that he could pitch a no-hitter and be a little dissatisfied with, hey, I missed the 2-1 pitch here or there. And I think that that's just who he is, but he's obviously a long way from that right now. He says it's not the same mechanical flaw that he was talking about in spring training, which means it's something new. He also says he's not hurt, so cross that off the list for now. But Aroldis Chapman said the same thing, and it turned out that he was. So who knows? I think that you don't have all the data right now. I'd like to see one or two more starts. I won't be surprised either way if he bounces back or if it continues, to be honest with you. But I am surprised that of all the people in the Yankee rotation, that he's one of the people that we're talking about right now.
So we're talking about this as a mechanical issue, and that's the word on the street, I guess. But do you think that there is anything having to do with his struggles that is correlated with the opt-out clause? Do you think there's some pressure here? I mean, everybody knows about it. It's kind of like the cloud that keeps covering him with the struggles that's got to come up. Do you think there's any kind of pressure on him that he's feeling and is affecting the way he's pitching?
I think it did bother him for a while. I think he was bothered by the repeated questions. And that was something Larry Rothschild even said earlier this spring. You know, if somebody keeps asking you, hey, do you think you're going to break your ankle today? At some point, you're going to just say, wait, why does everybody keep asking me if I'm going to break my ankle? Am I doing something wrong? So I think that, look, it could go. There's a track record of guys who have not been able to have nearly the amount of success that Tanaka has had with it. He's obviously found a way to work around it and continue strengthening it, but you have to remember that there is a tear there. It's not healing. You can make it stronger and you can pitch with it. Obviously he's proved that, but it's always in the back of everybody's mind. I think that The thing is here to look at the year he's having and to know that this is a potential opt-out year for him. Obviously, no one is more motivated for a number of reasons than Tanaka to have a great year this year, and he's just not doing it right now. So I think that whatever it is, he's obviously got to figure it out. But I think that splitter is so important to him. And you look back at the game tape against Houston, and it's just up in the zone. He was throwing hit me pitches, and there's a reason that the Astros had 8 runs on the board by the time it was the bottom of the second inning.
What is your opinion or just your feeling for being around the team on how the Yankees will handle the opt-out if he does indeed opt-out?
Yeah, that's a great question because I don't really know what kind of year Tanaka's going to have at the end, but my gut tells me no. My gut tells me that if he opts out, they will not bring him back. But I've heard this before, too. I've heard the Yankees swear up and down that they will not bring Alex Rodriguez back if he opts out, and then they gave him a 10-year deal. So I think that my gut instinct is that they would let Tanaka walk, especially if he's going out and seeking $25, $30 million a year. There's not a great starting pitching market out there. I mean, there are a couple options, I believe, but I think that they've got some good value on the Tanaka contract, but being that he's damaged goods in a way, you know, that obviously they've seen all the MRIs. They know everything better than we do. I think that they would probably shy away from that because if you think back and Tanaka had been hurt the way he is now, or at least pitching with a torn UCL, would he have gotten that kind of money in the first place? And my answer is probably no.
No, I can't imagine a team would take that kind of risk. But with CeCe, another guy who's struggling, and I still think the Yankees rotation is their Achilles heel this season. He looked so good in his first few starts, and I actually thought he turned a corner. He had a great season last year. I thought, okay, maybe he is going to be Andy Pettit 2.0, and he can pitch late into his career and just sort of figure it out. But it doesn't look like that anymore. How long is he going to be in the rotation if he continues to pitch like this?
I think you got to give him at least a few more turns to prove he can figure it out because, like you mentioned, he looked pretty good in the beginning part of the year. He looked great for the last, 5 or 6 weeks of last year. So that's a pretty good track record that it didn't just disappear overnight. Now, some of the peripheral numbers, you look at the exit velocity off him. A lot of the talk last year was that Sabathia was giving up soft contact. Well, he's not doing that anymore, especially the start at Cincinnati. He got rocked. You want to see what he does tonight in Kansas City. I think that obviously that's a last place team. It should, in theory, be a ballpark where he can get some fly ball outs if he has to. But I think that with Sabathia, there is a leash. Obviously, the fact that he's making such a big contract. And once you give up on him, this is the other thing. Once you give up on him and say, all right, CeCe Sabathia is not a starting pitcher anymore. He's now going to be our long reliever. He's going to be in the bullpen, and he's going to be an Adam Warren type, but not even that. He's going to be Chris Capuano from a couple years ago and just come in to mop up. Now you've lost him completely. Now you're not going to get any value out of that whatsoever. So I think that if there's any chance that he can come back and do what he did the last 2 months of last season, what he did the first 3 starts of this year, you gotta stick with it because and Girardi's inclined to do that as well. I mean, we all know Girardi seems to lean toward the veterans. He trusts the track record. He believes in them based upon that. So I think CeCe's got a long leash here.
How much influence does he have in the clubhouse? And is that at all a factor in keeping him in the rotation? Like you said, so they don't lose him and potentially lose a leader in the clubhouse.
Yeah. And like I said, that's huge because once you make him a long reliever, he's not going to be happy. He's not going to feel like he's contributing. So even if the team wins, he's not going to be the same presence that he would be. But no, he's huge. He's been there since 2009. I mean, this is a guy who was on the last World Series winning team. I think that obviously his track record speaks for itself. He's a Cy Young. He was a power pitcher who's reinvented himself. But he's got to start getting some results. And I think that's huge, though, for the pitching staff that nobody on that team wants to see CeCe Sabathia relegated to a bullpen role and just sitting out in the bullpen waiting for a lopsided game to get into. I think that he deserves better than that. I think it's in there. I think that, like I said, the last 2 months of last year and what you saw early this year, that couldn't have been a mirage or a fluke, but he's got to put it together.
And one more quick thing about CeCe Sabathia is, you know, we keep talking about sending him to the bullpen. I mean, this is something that he has not done. This is not a guy that can right. just go out there and, you know, be a bullpen guy. He's a starting pitcher. He's always been a starting pitcher. And at that, he's got a different repertoire at this point. So, I mean, there's absolutely nothing saying that if the Yankees were to send him to the bullpen, then that he would succeed in that role either. So.
No, and he doesn't have the overpowering kind of stuff that you would build a late inning reliever around. Obviously, they lost Chapman, but you can't compare Sabathia right now to even Tyler Clippard or Adam Warren or Dylan Betances, obviously. So, I mean, like I said, he's Chris Capuano from a couple of years ago if you decide to go that route. And to me, that's a sunk cost right there. So if there's any chance that he can be a competitive starting pitcher and give you – people weren't talking about CeCe giving him, you know, 7 or 8 innings every time. He needs to be competent and keep you in the game through 5 and let the bullpen do what it does. And if he can do that, then you can get some value out of it. And if not, then you're really just better off releasing him, to be honest with you. If you come to that point and just realize that he's just your mop-up guy, then just cut him loose, I think.
Talking about the team just a little bit differently going into first base, obviously this is an area that has not had any kind of production. We're looking around the diamond. We see production practically everywhere else, but first base has been an issue. Now 2 years standing. What's going on with Greg Bird and the Yankees' first base situation?
I mean, it has not been good. I mean, you look and they have gotten by far the worst production from first base. And anybody who saw Bird in spring training, I don't think you would have predicted that. I mean, he was crushing the ball and doing it against some pretty good pitchers too. It wasn't just against single A and double A kids, but I think that bone bruise had more of an impact than anybody let on. I think that he tried to play through it as much as he could, but obviously the fact that they're not even letting him get back to baseball activities right now tells you how bad it was and how much time he may need. So I think that Bird's going to be out a little while longer. Chris Carter obviously has not hit. That's not a secret. They don't have a whole lot else to go to right now. Tyler Austin apparently is hitting against live pitching. He tweeted that out. He's down there in Tampa, but he's basically starting spring training over again. So they're going to have to sink or swim with Chris Carter. I mean, there's not a whole lot else. I know somebody emailed me about G-Man Choi, who's apparently played pretty well down at AAA, but obviously not on the 40 and has not shown that he can do it in the big leagues yet. So I think that this Bird injury hurts them. Luckily, the team has been winning, so it hasn't been that much of an issue for them. But obviously, Bird wasn't hitting when he was on the team. Carter's not hitting now. So there's a reason that they're going to Matt Holliday and trying to give him some at-bats there at first base. Obviously, the bat has worked out well. The defense is passable, even though I don't think he looks comfortable there. But it clearly has been an issue for the Yankees. They've been able to win despite it, but it would be nice for the Yankees to start getting some contribution from first base, that's for sure.
Obviously, the Chapman injury hurts them, and it just sucks because they just gave him all this money, and it's one of those things that you hope is not long-term. Obviously, it might be a month or 2 months, depending on how severe the injury is. But Betances is going to be the closer. Obviously, Randy Levine in the offseason criticized Betances, basically said he couldn't be a closer. Do you think the Yankees are confident with him as the closer for the next 1 to maybe 2 months?
I don't know how Randy Levine feels about it, but I think that the Yankees in the clubhouse think he can. I know that he looked okay once the Chapman trade happened. He did not look great in September. He looked terrible. But before that, and I think that might have been a fatigue thing where he had just been used so heavily and he had made so many multi-inning appearances or more than one inning. Maybe he was just gassed there at the end of September. We'll find out. We will find out. This will be an opportunity for him to kind of put up or shut up and say, hey, I am a closer. I am a closer. Now the statistics prove it, and I deserve to be paid as one then. And look, I thought that whole thing was silly at the time, the way it was handled. It was over $2 million, and I'm not saying the Yankees should have just given him the $2 million, but they'd already won. They'd won their case, and then for Randy to take a victory lap, I think that a lot of people would agree it was uncalled for. They did it, so it's over. I think it's water under the bridge at this point, but I think that it would be pretty sweet. I'm sure if Dylan Betances could prove it, I think he'd feel really good about just kind of quietly saying, hey, I told you so. I told you I was worth that money, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Fans want to see that too.
I want to quickly talk about the stats and how StatCast is affecting and just has a larger role in baseball now. And talking about Dylan Betances, just so you know too, Brian, Andrew and I have come up with a new advanced metrics for Dylan, but it was really inspired by Dylan Betances, called BWIP, and it's bullpen warm up pitches. So that we can add that to the equation for his, his frustrations and loss of velocity towards the end of the season. But
right.
The Statcast distance, the exit velocity graphics, all these things. How are you guys getting him so fast? And do you think baseball is becoming too stats oriented?
I don't know the technical behind it. They just appear. They've got multi-million-dollar pieces of equipment installed in every ballpark, and they're hidden. They're hidden really well. But all that stuff, the pitch speed, the exit velocity, it is instantaneously transmitted, and it really is amazing to see what the computer can do. Because we're used to game day. And game day is a human person, obviously, inputting single to right field, runner advances to third base. So it takes a little while to refresh. But this is just the computer saying, all right, ball hit. Here's the exit velocity. Here's the distance, the launch angle, all that. It's really crazy. I mean, I think that there is so much data right now that I think for a lot of us, it's like trying to drink from a fire hose. There's just so much of it. Coming and you don't know what to do with some of it. I mean, so for me, I understand exit velocity, and that's something I can wrap my mind around, is that, wow, the ball is coming off Aaron Judge's bat a lot harder than everybody else. And that backs up what I'm seeing with my eyes. A lot of the other stuff, I think it's going to be a slow progression. And I know that there is a generation. I try to explain some of this stuff to my dad, and his eyes just glaze over. If you grew up watching Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and Duke Snider, and you batting average, home runs, and RBIs, that's all that matters. And I think there's not a whole lot I can do to convince you otherwise. But I think that a new generation is going to slowly or quickly embrace a lot of these stats. And I think that, look, this is what the teams are looking at as well. And so I think that our coverage is catching up to what the teams have known and been diving into for the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, exit velocity is – go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, baseball is looking for sexy things too. I mean, the sexy numbers that Aaron Judge is putting up with 120, 119 miles per hour exit velocity. I think they like these big numbers because people like to see those big numbers, and they like to see home runs and guys throw 100 miles an hour and, all these things. So I think it's also just – it's helping the younger generation, I think, attach some semblance of sexiness to the game.
Well, there's a reason why when Chapman comes in, for example, and the scoreboard says 101, 102, you hear, from the crowd, people are watching for that. So whether it's that, at some point, you'll know more about the exit velocity and stuff. But, I mean, honestly, you don't need exit velocity to tell you Aaron Judge hits the ball farther and harder than pretty much anybody else in the league right now. And it's pretty awesome to watch him on a daily basis. I just like going down to the field and watching him take BP. I feel like that's a show in itself.
Absolutely. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. And are you in Kansas City right now?
I am not, but I will be at the Trop in Tampa. So I will be with the team on Friday.
That's a lovely ballpark.
You know what? For our purposes, though, I got to be honest with you. I know I would not probably want to pay money to – it would not be my first choice to watch a game. But for our purposes, it's indoors. You never get a rain delay. There's a dedicated stairwell. Goes right down the clubhouse. The Wi-Fi is fine. They've got hot coffee. I have no complaints about the crowd.
All right. Well, Brian, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.